evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm the host for this evening of Your Legal Rights, Josh Borger. When people face catastrophes after losing their house to a wildfire or a flood, or perhaps their business is in dire straits due to COVID-19, what do they do if there's a question of whether they have insurance coverage? Maybe there's a question of whether the policy is in effect or whether the policy applied to this kind of event. In late March, we featured a broader look at insurance coverage. Tonight, we delve deeper and look at issues surrounding insurance coverage as it applies to COVID-19 and natural disasters. Do you have questions regarding COVID-19 or natural disasters as they relate to insurance coverage or insurance law or insurance claims? Then please give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area, or if you're outside the dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all the salient facts of your situation. We are happy to share the legal principles to help guide your decision-making or maybe direct you where you can find some help. You can contact us tonight with any question on insurance law. You're not limited to the point we're at in our conversation. To guide us through this examination of insurance coverage and insurance claims, we have two esteemed experts with us. The first, Tiburon attorney Kathleen DeFever, is both a public insurance adjuster and an insurance litigator with extensive experience and knowledge about insurance claims, the insurance market, and the experience of the insurance consumer. Ms. DeFever is one of the few professionals in the United States who has worked as both a public insurance adjuster and an insurance litigator, and is personally dedicated to the improvement of the consumer's experience with insurance. Having received her Master's of Insurance Law from the University of Connecticut School of Law, home of the world-renowned Insurance Law Center and located in the world's insurance capital of Hartford, Connecticut, Kathleen is the author of the blog Misinsured. Joining us from Scheidmantel Law Group in Pasadena, California, David Scheidmantel has been a lawyer for more than 30 years. He focuses his practice on insurance coverage and counseling on behalf of policyholders and construction litigation. David and Kathleen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a great platform to be able to speak with Kathleen on these important issues faced by our listeners today. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Sure. Let's start here. Many businesses, small, medium, large, have suffered closures and business losses because of the shutdowns to address the COVID-19 pandemic. What insurance policies would cover those losses?
Well, the first thing a policyholder would want to do if their business has faced shutdowns as a result of COVID-19 is to get a hold of their property insurance policy. Within many or even most property insurance policies, is a loss of business income portion of the coverage, which is more colloquially known as business interruption insurance. And the purpose of that insurance is to provide coverage for the policyholder when there is some event that causes them to have a loss to their property such that they are unable to conduct their business. So those types of coverages are located in the property policy or in the renter's policy for those who lease their facility.
And I would add that sometimes the name of the policy will be something along the lines of small business coverage, like this. But you probably know if you have a business interruption coverage because you probably own a business that you have insured.
Is that a separate policy, or is that an addendum rider onto a different policy you have?
Well, typically, it's part of the property policy or the commercial policy or the renter's policy. There are certainly standalone business interruption policies, but they're in my experience, more rare than simply being a part of the property or renter's policy. And I would say, I'd like to add, Josh, that a lot of times policyholders don't even know what their insurance policy is. When they bought their policy, maybe they bought it 5 years ago, and they were issued a policy, and maybe it's stuck in a drawer somewhere. And every year they get a renewal, and the renewal has a declarations page, and it has some other endorsements and changes to the policy. But it's not really the policy. It's more like the amendments to the policy. And so as a coverage lawyer, and I'm sure Kathleen has the same experience, I like to joke that the hardest part about being a coverage lawyer is getting a hold of the policy, because policyholders don't know what it is, don't know where it is, and don't know how to find it. So that's the first step, is always to get a hold of the policy.
And how has the insurance industry responded to people tendering claims for business interruption coverage?
Well, the wholesale response from insurance companies has been to deny the claims, and they target a couple of different clauses in the policies. Number one, they claim that there's been no direct physical loss on the property, meaning particularly with coronavirus. They are using the fact that it's incredibly difficult to prove that coronavirus was present on a property to deny and claim that there was no direct loss. The virus was not there. That is one of the major arguments they're using, and really the primary major argument, because if they can win on that argument, they can deny coverage entirely. There are a couple of other arguments they're using, that there was no business interruption because business owners were allowed to continue their business. There was no direct shutdown from a government authority, and so there was no interruption. And, you know, there's language in most policies that allow for coverage for an interruption when a government authority shuts down operations. Under the coronavirus circumstances, it doesn't really match the language of the policy. And so the insurance companies are really leveraging the fact that the language that we have in our current policies pre-coronavirus doesn't address a situation like a pandemic, and just arguing very hard, entrenched in the position that there's just no coverage whatsoever. And they're quite successful at it, although I think David is more abreast of what is going on in the courts than I would be. But I know there are a lot of cases out there that are not settled, and it really could still go either way.
Well, let me add on to that and say that I would add, Kathleen, that the universal response by the carriers has not only been to deny coverage, but in many instances they simply ignore the claim, and you never hear from the insurance company, which is a challenge to actually get a response. But yeah, we've seen the courts, very interesting. Very early on, the federal courts were the ones that were primarily dealing with this. And as our listeners may be aware, we have a system where there are state courts and then there are also federal courts. And in the instances in federal court, I would say a large majority of cases have been ruling in favor of the insurance company. And the critical language in these policies is direct physical loss or damage to covered property. And somehow, pre-COVID, the notion crept into the law, at least in these federal cases, that this required an actual physical alteration of the structure. And that's really what these courts that have been ruling against the policyholders have been focusing on. They're looking, has there been a physical alteration of the structure by the actual or potential presence of coronavirus in the building. And the courts have been ruling against policyholders on that basis. But what we've been seeing, number one, is the state courts tend to be focusing on the language loss rather than damage. And so the policyholder does have a loss. They can't use their property for what it was intended to be used for. And so the state courts, you know, it started out very, again, insurance company centric, but then more and more cases have been coming out in the state courts. And we're actually thinking we see like a 50-50 split in the state courts and the federal courts, where we've seen the negative rulings. We're almost exclusively on the district court level. That's the trial court level. So we haven't even gotten to the appellate level, where appeals courts will start to take a look at this and realize that, why are these courts ignoring the word loss and just focusing on damage?
Let me ask a follow-up without getting too technical for our listeners. I know of a case out there that says that it was a house that hadn't collapsed, but the court said no one in their right mind would go into this house because it's on the verge of collapse and it will collapse. But if you showed someone a picture, they would say, no, it hasn't collapsed. It's on the verge. The policy covered a collapse, and the court said that's a collapse. Couldn't you make the same analogy here to property damage?
Yes, Josh. There's also a case very similar to that in which a home was next to a cliff, and there was a giant boulder on the cliff that was loose and sure to fall soon. And so the insurance company argued, well, there's no loss of use to this home. You can still live in it. And was ostensibly making the argument that until the boulder collapsed on the house, which of course could injure or kill someone, then there was no coverage. And the court in that case ruled, no, there is a loss. It's too dangerous to be in this home. The boulder is going to fall in the home. So that's very similar to what you're describing here with the possibility of collapse of a home. And there is case law that has held that it should be covered, even though the actual direct physical loss has not occurred yet. Per se, the action has not occurred yet, but there is still a loss because it's too dangerous to be on the property. So that's absolutely correct.
That's a really excellent point, Kathleen. And I'd like to add, maybe taking this in a slightly different direction, Josh, that even in those instances in which there is a recognized loss that will be covered, the question is, what is covered? And what is the extent of the policyholder's loss? And that's exactly where Kathleen's discipline as a public adjuster comes into play. Because as a public adjuster, Kathleen looks at the type of loss, how to measure the loss, what the true economic impact of the loss is. And that's exactly what she does and what is necessary in order to deal with the insurance company. Now, Kathleen is a public adjuster, which is a strange word. It sounds as if she somehow, as well as being a coverage lawyer herself, is a public adjuster. But a public adjuster makes it sound like she represents the government or something like that. But that's not the case. Public adjuster means she takes care of policyholders. And it's very important for policyholders to have their own public adjuster, because the insurance company for sure has its own adjuster, and it's actually called an independent adjuster, which is also very much of a misnomer, because they're not independent at all. They're on the side of the insurance company. So unknowing policyholders, they're unsuspecting. They think the insurance company is their friend. They think this independent adjuster is going to be independent and come in and help them. They're actually trying to adjust the claim as far downward as they can on behalf of the insurance company. And that's why someone like Kathleen, a public adjuster, comes in and says, oh, no, We need to look at this and see what the actual losses were. I have a property claim right now where, with the help of a public adjuster, we were able to increase from $600,000 to $2 million, the amount of the covered claim. We would never have been able to do that without the careful work of the public adjuster going through all of the detail and finding out what is required for this claim, what's the true loss.
Yeah, that's correct. Public adjusters really are they're like your quarterback on the football field. They know who all the players are in the claim process, and they know who to call when and how to determine what the numbers should be or could be, whereas David and I are also both insurance attorneys on the consumer side. We understand the law, the legal history. So really, the way I try to explain it in the best way that I can is the public adjuster will help you manage your claim before it becomes a legal issue. Now, it's an excellent idea to have a lawyer watching that if you can, or someone like myself who also knows the legal ramifications, so that in case it becomes a legal issue, you're ready for it. But it's not absolutely necessary in most cases, because public insurance adjusters are also well-versed on what your legal rights are, because they do study the law. They're not allowed to practice law. I will definitely caution that. But they're aware of what the rules are. So really, you get a public adjuster to manage the claim. And then if it turns into a legal dispute, you need an insurance attorney, a specialized insurance attorney, to manage the insurance legal portion. And I want to add, we have all these business interruption claims in the courts right now that are not being managed by counsel that have background in insurance law. And I think David can disagree or agree with me on this one, but I think that a lot of the negative results that are occurring, a lot of the denials of these claims in courts, are because there aren't enough insurance attorneys specialists, and general attorneys are taking these claims, and it's an overwhelming thing to take on, because insurance law is very, very different from every other type of law that there is.
I couldn't agree more, Kathleen. I think as much as I highly respect our brethren in the personal injury realm, to ask a personal injury lawyer to deal with a complicated insurance coverage matter is kind of like asking your very skilled internist to do brain surgery. You don't want to do that. If you need brain surgery, you need a brain surgeon. And the types of things that Kathleen and I do in the insurance coverage area are highly technical, more technical than most people realize. And they need, policyholders need true expert assistance from people who really know coverage law in order to deal with that. And they actually need a team. We have our insurance brokers, we have our insurance adjusters, and we have our insurance coverage lawyers, and they're all part of that team.
Thank you, David. That was brilliantly diplomatic. Now, we have a call from Steve in San Francisco. Steve, welcome to
the Legal. Thank you guys very much. This is a great program. I'd go you even one more, that if you're getting some brain surgery, you want to get it from a guy who does 100 of them a year, not somebody who does 5 of them a year. So somebody who knows what's going on. Would your guest please talk about two things? I'm on the board of my condo association, and it's often been said that there's 10 times as much damage done by water than there is by fire. We had one here where somebody, the washing machine, the hose broke, and they were out of town or something, and it flooded their unit, the next unit, and then one over, too, because the water kept on going. And then also, would they talk about storms, and the technical term is called wind-driven rain. And so the person who's insured has got to say, well, the rain got inside the house because the wind blew off a hole in the roof or something. But if it was just caused by the rain itself, then it might not be covered. Thank you, and I'll take the answers off the air.
Well, if our panelists have any comments on that, we're happy to keep it on.
Yeah, if you could stay on the air, I'm not sure what our caller is asking us about the condo insurance and the flooding.
Right. Are you asking us whether what you've described is covered? I was a little unclear myself. Could you let me know what your question is? I think he's off.
Well, let me riff about that a little bit. I think we can take a look and say that, you know, when you look at these property policies, you're going to see various exclusions that the insurance companies attempt to rely on regarding floods and whatnot. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not coverage, because if there's water damage caused by, say, a sudden and accidental event from a burst pipe, it may result in significant water damage. But in those situations, we look for getting past the insurance company's reliance on some sort of flood exclusion. Yeah, there was a lot of water, but it wasn't like some sort of tsunami flood that occurred. So I often see in matters like that, the insurance companies overreaching in their attempts to rely on anything water-related in the policy where there's an exclusion. And I've seen so many times, just almost, I would say, if I can go here, Josh, I would almost say fraudulent descriptions of what went on when the insurance companies try to paint a water situation and try to call it a leak rather than an actual burst pipe or a situation where there was a sudden event. We've had several of those. And at the end of the day, you know, just a matter of proof. And very often the insurance companies don't even do the investigatory work to determine what the actual cause of the loss was. And it takes attention and vigilance to get past that with the companies.
You may go there because you already did. So let's transition a little bit back to the French Laundry. Was a case that was very interesting. Thomas Keller, the owner of the French Laundry, sued on behalf of the French Laundry for business interruption coverage, and he lost. And as David was remarking, it seems that the insurance companies are doing better in federal court. The insureds are doing better in state court. He was in federal. He lost. Who's going to win out at the end of the day on all this? If you're someone who doesn't have $500,000 to spend on a lawyer, is it worth getting a lawyer and litigating for your business interruption coverage? Or do you just want to wait and see what happens?
Well, I would say that in the first instance, don't wait to assert a claim. If you have a claim, hopefully you already submitted it. There's no good reason to avoid submitting it. Get it out there in front of the insurance company. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the insurance policy very well might have a limitation on the time that you have in order to assert your claim. For example, many policies say a year after the loss. So that might be extended based a year after the denial by California state law. So you might have a little bit more time, or maybe the insurance company never replied at all and you'd have even more time, but don't wait. And the second reason is when you get your renewal, you can imagine that the policies that are being renewed contain far more restrictive provisions regarding coronavirus and other viruses that you want to be careful of. So don't delay your claim. That's point number one. Point number two is you may, depending on the size of your claim, want to sit back and wait once you've asserted it. You watch your statute, you watch your policy, you see when is my true limitation on when I can commence suit. Again, we have that one-year problem, but let's see how the law develops to some extent. And what I've really been observing is that the bigger claims are now being filed by hotels, by concert venues, by chains of fitness facilities. You know, we're seeing those bigger claims. So we really don't know. I think the insurance company might have jumped up and down and cheered a little too early with some of its early victories. And we really don't know where this is going to end up. And what policyholders should do of whatever size is do what they need to do to keep their claim alive. Don't let the time restrictions lapse. They have to file a case, just file it and sit back, but keep it alive.
Who do you think is right?
Between the insurance company and the consumer?
Well, look, you're about to watch a football game. People place bets. Who do you think is right? Who do you think is going to win out? We're not holding you to this, but how do you think it's going to play out at the end of the day?
Oh, gosh, I have two different answers for that. Who do I think is right and who do I think will win are two different answers. I absolutely think the consumer is right because there is law backing up the claim that there is a loss here due to COVID-19. except possibly in the instances where there is a specific virus exclusion. Those cases are more challenging, which the French Laundry case does involve a virus exclusion. But who do I think is going to win? I think consumer attorneys, frankly, are outgunned. And you have, in our governmental system, you have lobbyists, insurance company lobbyists and litigators who are convincing, you know, anyone in a position of power, frankly. I mean, of course, our representatives, but the message gets around to the general public when, you know, basically, if you shout enough that there's no fire, people start to believe that there's no fire. And they're excellent at messaging. They're absolutely excellent at it. I respect defense attorneys on the insurance company side with the utmost respect, because they're very good at what they do. And they came out early and they came out strong, and they did a lot of arm waving and jumping up and down, just asserting there's no coverage here. There never was coverage here. We never intended for there to be coverage here. And that message is absolutely everywhere. And so it's an uphill battle. I wish that I was felt more positive about it. If you ask me my analysis of the legal, of the law and the case law and the regulations, I absolutely think there is coverage, but do I think it will be granted? I have my doubts.
It's interesting, you know, coverage law is not uniform, and there are 50 states with 50 states' laws, and the coverage law in each jurisdiction differs. That's part of the art of what we do as insurance coverage lawyers, is examine the law in the various jurisdictions that might come into play in the coverage situation that we're dealing with. And as we've said, we're observing a trend towards more coverage. And I don't think there'll be any one answer to your question, Josh. I think we're going to see a lot of successes. We're going to see some failures, but it will be very interesting to see how it develops. And I think it will depend in large part on good lawyering and good positioning as we move these cases forward.
Kathleen, you mentioned the virus exclusion. If you get a response from your insurance company denying coverage due to a virus exclusion, is that the end of the day? Is it game over?
No, absolutely not, because the virus exclusions were not written with the intent to exclude something similar to the coronavirus pandemic. They were written very broadly, and they're vague. And when there's vagueness in the policy, there is a court-written rule through case law that the policy terms should be interpreted in favor of the policyholder's reasonable interpretation. So if I'm a policyholder and I read that virus exclusion and I think, well, that surely doesn't apply to my situation, that's an absolutely valid interpretation. So no, the door is not closed on virus exclusions.
Any other, I would add to that, you know, how is the policy, how is the virus exclusion added to the policy is a question. Now, the virus exclusion came into being in the early 2000s as a result of SARS. That's when insurance companies started introducing the virus exclusion. That's useful because there are those policies that don't have a virus exclusion. We know that the insurance companies had the ability to put in one if they chose to. So if there's not one there, I think that's generally an argument in favor of coverage for those policyholders who have policies that don't have virus exclusion. But merely because there's an exclusion in the policy does not necessarily mean that it applies. How was it introduced? The law generally is that at the time of renewal, when a reduction in coverage, such as a key exclusion, is introduced, it needs to be done so in a manner that is conspicuous, plain, and clear. That's the legal language. It has to be conspicuous, plain, and clear. So if you've had a policy since 2000, when did that virus exclusion come into your policy? I have clients who have policies going back to the 90s. When did that exclusion come into the policy, and how was it disclosed? Hopefully you saved your policies in your renewal forms, and if not, you can get them from somewhere, hopefully from the insurance company. But don't necessarily say, oh, exclusion, game over, better luck next time. No, take a look. Where did my exclusion come from? And then I echo what Kathleen says about the clarity of the exclusion. And I've seen a recent case that just said, this is so convoluted that no policyholder in the planet could ever understand it. I'm going to let this case go forward. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we're looking at. I've had a case where the insurance company's own witnesses said that they couldn't understand the policy because they weren't trained in coverage, as if their policyholders were, which of course they're not.
And on that note, let's take a quick station break.
It's All Songs Considered from NPR Music. I'm Bob Boylan.
And I'm Robin Hilton.
We love music, all kinds, and every week we literally go through hundreds of songs just to find the best new music out there.
Tunes from emerging bands and musical icons, too. If it's new and good, we'll play it and talk about it, too.
Check out the show right here on this station.
That's All Songs Considered from NPR Music.
All Songs Considered. This evening at 8 o'clock, preceded by Q from the CBC at 7 o'clock here on KALW San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Welcome back to Your Legal Rights. I'm Josh Borger. We're talking about insurance coverage as it relates to COVID-19 and natural disasters. Give us a call if you have any questions at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you've been in the Bay Area, or if you're outside of the local dialing area, that's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Now, going back to the exclusions for a second, if an exclusion was slipped in there at some point, do you have a claim against your insurance broker who procured the policy? Or at any point in this, is the fault that you're being denied coverage due to the insurance broker?
Well, Josh, yes, it could be the fault of the insurance broker, but the legal guidelines on brokers, they're called their duty of care in legal terminology, is extremely minimal. So lawsuits against brokers and agents are almost never successful. I like to explain it this way. They have a duty to, if you ask for a policy, they have a duty to procure you a policy. And that's basically it. They don't have a duty to explain the policy to you. They don't have a duty to ensure the policy matches your needs. You're really on your own when you're purchasing insurance coverage. And so I often have clients ask me, well, then what do I need an agent or broker for? What are they actually offering me? And the answer, to be perfectly honest, is not much, because if you have a problem, you cannot recover from them, even if it was due to their mistake.
So you send them an email and you said, I need coverage for X very specifically. They said, absolutely. I have this policy. It's perfect. It's everything you need. You will be covered for X. And it turns out you're not. You have no claim against them.
You do not. You can make a claim, but the odds of being successful are extremely low. All that being said, there are many wonderful brokers who care and impose their own duty of care upon themselves to do their job properly. So what's really important is to ensure that you find a broker or an agent that you trust that really is trying to make sure that you get the correct coverage.
Yeah, I have the highest degree of respect for a lot of brokers, and some of them do an amazing job understanding the business or the needs of the policyholder and attempting to buy the right policy for the policyholder and explaining what the policyholder needs. And they also do something that's very important, not certainly not universally, maybe even rarely, And that is to take the policyholder's hand and help the policyholder through the application process to make sure the application is filled out properly and in a way that won't hurt the policyholder later. So a key issue for people to understand is the difference between an agent and a broker. So a broker is kind of an independent person, and they deal with multiple insurance companies, and they get bids for different types of coverage from different companies to help the policyholder secure the right coverage. The agent works for an insurance company. There are insurance companies like Allstate and State Farm and Geico and AAA, and these work through agents. The agents work for the insurance companies. They're an extension of the insurance companies. That's not to say that they don't care for their clients and take care of them, and very often they do, but that distinction needs to be understood. And so in the hypothetical, Josh, you came up with, if you went to your insurance broker or even your insurance agent and said, I need business interruption insurance and my property policy, and they said, yeah, it's in there, fine. And then later you find out there's a virus exclusion, I can't imagine a situation in which the agent or a broker would have any liability for that. The situations where we might see liability is where there's a specific conversation or a specific request for a type of coverage. A very direct, literal, and extreme example would be if you went to your broker and said, I need a policy that doesn't have a virus exclusion, and you end up with a policy that has a virus exclusion. I think then you might have some legs in your claim against the broker. But what I don't like to see are people just as a knee-jerk reaction suing both the insurance company and the insurance broker. I think that's unfair to the broker in many instances, and is counterproductive for the policyholder, because you want the broker, you, the policyholder, want the broker to be your ally as you proceed against the insurance company. So I'm always very careful with policyholders about whether they should sue their broker, and 9 times out of 10, for the reasons that Kathleen identified and for the strategic reasons, ordinarily we don't do that.
You've mentioned various policies that may contain this coverage and a split in courts on whether there is coverage. So I take it it's fair to say that people are not going to be able to pick up any one of their insurance policies, read it, and have a clear understanding of whether or not they have coverage. They're going to have to hire a lawyer. Is that fair?
Sadly, I think it is, Josh, because I think these policies are written in a, I'm going to say, intentionally gray way, and in an incompetent way. And both of those things make the policies very difficult to understand. And really, it takes someone who knows how to read these policies to know what's there. You can have a virus exclusion on page 10 and then come up with an endorsement on page 43 that changes what's in that virus exclusion and may provide a different avenue of coverage that some ordinary person reading their policy would never understand.
And as you've already said, many lawyers wouldn't understand. So in that sense, get a specialist.
Well, I'll tell you an extreme example. I was in court not too long ago, and the insurance coverage, the insurance company's lawyer was arguing in front of the court. And we said, show us in that policy where there's a lead exclusion. And he futzed around for 10 minutes before the court said, well, let's move on, because he couldn't find it either.
So if your insurance agent or broker says, don't bother filing a claim, they're all getting denied, listen to them or do it anyway.
Kathleen, let's say it in unison. Do not listen.
Do not listen. File the claim. They're getting the same messaging I was referring to, that insurance companies, insurance litigators are projecting. There's no coverage, absolutely no coverage. They're telling that as well to especially the agents, because as David pointed out, agents work for the insurance companies, but the brokers are getting that same message And it's not that they don't want you to be paid, particularly with brokers. Brokers really care, for the most part, about their clients. It's just that they're getting that overwhelming message. But do not listen. You need to file the claim and at least trigger your rights so that you don't have your statute of limitations expiring. And then you find out in 2 years, oh, maybe I could have been paid, but I listened to other people tell me there's no claim and I never filed the claim.
So you file the claim, a month goes by, you're ignored. Another month goes by, they're ignoring you. A third month, still ignoring you. Can you give some practical tips to our guests? How do you deal with the insurance company who you give them the claim and you're just getting ignored, or you're getting the runaround, or you're getting letters saying, we'll get back to you? What are some tips for these people?
Well, first I'd say that the California law puts time limitations on insurance companies for when they're supposed to respond to claims. And there's a 30-day requirement where they're supposed to either meaningfully respond to the claim or explain why they're not doing so. So if you have an insurance company that's simply ignoring you, the most tempting response from a coverage lawyer is, well, take them to court, file a lawsuit, get them in front of the judge. Maybe even that helps because the insurance company then gets a coverage lawyer themselves, shows up, and maybe there's a faster response as a result of that. I follow-up letters to insurance companies sometimes work, sometimes doesn't. I think during COVID, we've seen not only a strategic response or non-response from insurance companies to COVID-19 insurance claims and really other types of claims as well, but also a COVID-19 work-at-home kind of overworked general approach to these things where they're not really, they're just not responding because they're busy. So sometimes it helps to be the squeaky wheel. So usually before I would ever file a lawsuit, I'd at least follow up with one or two letters and see whether you can get a response from the insurance company. And when they realize there's coverage counsel involved, And just a claim by the policyholder themselves or the broker just might not be enough to do it. And we earlier talked about brain surgery and internists. You know, I'll draw another analogy, and that is if you look at, say, you have a property and you're flipping your property. You have an architect who's helping you design your changes, you have a contractor who's performing them, and you have a real estate broker who's helping you sell your property. Don't make the mistake of relying on the architect for the work of the contractor. Don't make the mistake of relying on the contractor for the work of the broker. Same deal. Insurance broker, insurance adjuster, insurance coverage lawyer. We do different things. Don't rely on your insurance broker necessarily to be your primary advocate in asserting your claim against the insurance company.
I would add that we have statutes in California in the insurance code that require your insurance company to respond to you, in most cases in 14 days after you file a claim. But what's important, the important factor to uphold your rights under that statute is everything needs to be in writing. If you mail them a letter or send them an email that says, I have a claim, I need you to respond to me, document when you mailed it. Always do return, receipt, requested, or certified mail so you know that it got delivered. Keep a copy of that letter. Have proof that it was delivered. Same thing with the emails. Don't delete your emails and make sure it's always in writing. If you call them to make a claim and then you never hear anything, then you don't have the proof that you need that you made the claim. They can argue that you never called. They don't remember that. If they're requiring you to call and that's the only method you can find on your policy to make a claim, write down when you made the call, make notes while you're on the call or as soon as you get off the call, because from a legal perspective, the notes being made at the same time makes them more reliable. And keep your phone records. You know, protect yourself. Think about how you can prove that you made that claim. And then if you're not getting a response, send another letter. send another letter. Keep it in writing and keep your records. Oh, and to add to that, you can call the insurance commissioner's office, the Department of Insurance, and tell them, I'm not getting a response. Am I not entitled to a response within 14 days? And they have a system in which they can look into that for you.
I'll say two things about that. First of all, or three, actually. One is that one needs to be very careful about what you say about your claim and how you describe it. Because without an understanding of your policy, you might express your claim in a way that does not fit well within the strictures of the policy. So be very careful about what you say. It usually tends to be best to say as little as possible. You just want to keep the ball in the air. Two, the insurance company, if they're actually paying attention, is going to start asking you for things. And there are two dangers when it comes to asking you for things. One of them is ignoring the insurance company and not providing what they're asking. And two is to give them too much in a way that's harmful to your position. So you need to be strategic and advised about what you actually provide to the insurance company.
And on that note, we have a caller, Roy, from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. This may be off topic, but maybe you can help me. I have dealings with a brokerage house that holds my late mother's trust, and they're not responding to me. And I wondered what kind of counsel should I be seeking?
Well, it sounds as if you're dealing with a broker who's not an insurance broker, and we're talking about insurance brokers. Okay. So I would look at what type of brokerage is actually holding that trust. And you might need to consult with a trusts and estates lawyer or a probate lawyer who might be able to advise you about that. But I don't think that you're probably looking for an insurance coverage lawyer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Roy. So in addition to business interruption coverage, are there other types of policies that come into play as a result of the pandemic?
Well, I'll answer that by saying one very creative argument that a lot of policyholders have been making is that putting aside the whole notion of business interruption, that the virus actually constitutes pollution. And there are policyholders that have pollution policies that protect them when pollution is present on their properties. So if you're a business and you have a pollution policy, take a look at that as well. And don't simply rely on your property policy and the business interruption or lost business income aspects of that policy. Number two, if you're an employer, you'll certainly want to have an understanding of your workers' comp policy, which usually has associated with it an employer's liability policy. California law generally provides that if an employee is in a workplace and develops coronavirus, that there's a presumption that they develop the coronavirus in the context of their employment, and there will be workers' comp coverage. So employers should be well attuned to providing their employees with the necessary forms to submit when there is a workers' comp claim resulting from coronavirus. Employers' liability is a slightly different animal, and it protects employers from employment-related claims that aren't necessarily or are not covered by workers' comp. For example, if there is a family member of the infected employee, the family member might actually assert a claim against the employer. And that's when they'll want to look for their employer's liability policy and make sure that the insurance company is notified of that claim.
Let me switch gears a little bit. We spent a great deal of time talking about COVID-19, but let's talk a little bit about natural disasters. California's in a drought. So we have had years of wildfires where people's homes have been destroyed by the fire. But in addition, your home might not have been destroyed, but you have smoke damage. It could, you could have a well. It could have burned the well and you have to leave and you have no water at your house. You can't be there. Are these things covered?
Well, Josh, it will really depend on the policy. Generally, something like a well is not specifically worded into the policy. So the challenge of a public insurance adjuster will be to find coverage for the well, because obviously if you're buying property coverage, you are buying the coverage so that you can use your property, and property is not very useful without water, without an operational well. Another one that comes up very often is bridges. If you live near a creek or a river and you had a bridge in your driveway, bridges are not specifically delineated in a policy, but you can't even access the property to make repairs if your bridge is not reinstalled. So these are questions for public insurance adjusters. They handle them on a daily basis. What was the first example that you made before you mentioned the wells? Oh, smoke damage. I wanted to rate that because in the new policies I'm seeing, which are being issued, smoke damage is being excluded. You need to check in your policy if you've bought a recent policy to see if smoke damage is excluded. That is a huge, huge decrease in coverage. If you don't lose your home, but your neighbor's house burns down, or if you're in a wildfire zone and there's smoke everywhere, insurance companies have lost, in their mind, it's a loss on their ledger, a lot of money due to needing to gut out homes and clean them from smoke damage. And now they're just completely excluding it. And those exclusions, as David mentioned earlier, exclusions are added and no one, and people don't notice that they've been added, and they don't realize that their coverage just took a significant decrease.
I agree with everything Kathleen said, and I would add to that that even when there is coverage, that's especially when you need Kathleen, because in those instances, the insurance company is going to lowball the claim and do everything they can to come up with some reason why it's only 25% of what your actual harm is. And if you just go with what they say, you're going to be undercompensated. And that's when you need a public adjuster to come in and argue with the independent adjuster hired by the insurance company to explain what your true loss is. The other thing I would say about this generally is that people tend to, when they start out their lives, they've just gotten married, they're a young family, and they get an insurance policy from a consumer-oriented insurance company. And then which really does the job for them at the time. That's all they can afford. That's all that's available. But then, you know, in 10 years, they get a bigger house, and then they're successful, and they get another house, and pretty soon they have a house that's worth $2.5 million. And they've never had a problem, and they've always stuck with their consumer-oriented insurance company. And then they have an issue, and that is when the deficiencies in the insurance policies provided by the consumer-oriented insurance companies come into play. So as you progress in your life and your maturity, our listeners need to understand when they might need a higher level or a higher grade of coverage. And at that point, they need to go away from the agent model and go towards more the broker model and talk to a broker who is actually able to fashion an insurance program that is attuned to the value of your assets.
Excellent advice. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
We are going to be running out of time soon. Do each one of you want to take a few minutes and give some advice to our callers on any number of insurance-related issues that you want to talk about?
I have one thing I'd like to add. You know, David and I both know that this is an overwhelming process when you have an insurance claim, and we're doing our level best to explain who you might want to contact and who you might not want to contact. But there's another resource that's absolutely free that I always recommend if you're still confused or if you can't get a hold of who you think you need to talk to, and that's United Policyholders. It's a nonprofit organization in San Francisco that is dedicated specifically to these types of questions. If you're not sure, call them first and they will point you in the right direction or possibly even provide you with the resources you're looking for.
I love that organization, Kathleen, and it's a great point. And I think what United Policyholder does stands in stark contrast, unfortunately, to the California Insurance Department. And when people, in every instance in which I'm aware, and anyone has submitted a complaint to the California Insurance Department, it hasn't. They've simply never gotten a response. And I don't want our listeners to think that is necessarily something that's going to end up helping them at the end of the day. I think United Policyholders stands in stark contrast to that and tends to be very helpful. The other thing, Josh, I would like to leave our listeners with is, in my own mind, I think of insurance claims and losses I'll think of it as the hockey ice. And when a policyholder has a complicated situation and they think the insurance company and is their friend and they think they can go it alone, I picture an open net with the offensive players coming down and just putting that puck right in the net. The policyholder has no protection. Policyholder needs a very strong goalie in the net, someone to protect the policy. And they need to understand that it's not necessarily any one of the members of a team who can protect the policyholder. They need to think about that in advance and get some really good professional advice.
Josh, if we have another minute, I could add another interesting aspect to the process. So I do a lot of research on comparative insurance law between the United States and the European Union and the United Kingdom. The way they've handled their policy, their claims under COVID-19 in the United Kingdom and the European Union has been completely opposite of the way that they've been handled here. Early on, they formed a commission to look into whether there should be coverage for particularly business interruption claims. And it was decided almost overwhelmingly that there is coverage. Why is that interesting to know in the United States? Well, because those policies are extremely similar to the policies we have here. So I think in a larger economic sense, we're going to see that the European Union is going to come out of COVID-19 with a little less trauma, so to speak, to the economy than we are. We're losing all these small businesses, medium-sized, large businesses are having problems as well. And we're going to really see the stark contrast here very soon.
Thank you
for that. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we take a look at current environment of COVID-19, natural disasters and insurance law. Our guests tonight have been David Scheidmantel from Scheidmantel Law Group in Pasadena and Kathleen DeFever of DeFever Law in Tiburon. Tonight's show was produced by Jeff Hayden and yours truly. Please join us next week at the same time where we'll take a look at the ins and outs of family law. Again, a big thank you to tonight's guests and a thank you to all of you for joining us at the controls tonight. Damian D. Minor, I'm your host for tonight, Josh Borger. Everyone take care and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.